UK Wine Show, show number 169. Chablis with Natalie and Jill Febb. G'day. Welcome to the UK Wine Show. It's the 14th of April 2009 and my name's Chris Scott. I'm off camping this weekend down to the southeast corner of England, but with the forecast due to be overcast, it may be cooler than I'd hoped for. It certainly wasn't that cold when I went to Chablis about 4 weeks ago when I recorded this show. 30 degrees the day I turned up, with 35 degrees the day before. So very nice. Okay, let's get into the show though. This week we've got a great show. In the spotlight, we review the book Wine for Dummies, and our mystery grape is a Spanish red variety. And I'll give you some clues now, and I'll give you more clues after the news and see if you guys can work it out. Although it produces deep coloured wines, it doesn't have a particularly strong flavour identity and is quite low in acidity. So alone, the wines lose their fruit and liveliness in a few years. This is the reason why it's often blended with juicier, more perfumed varieties to produce wonderful wines capable of ageing. It prefers deep calcareous or sandy clay soils and does best on slopes. In Spain, it's known by many synonyms, including Tinto Fino and Tinto de Toro. Elsewhere, it's grown in Portugal and the Douro, as well as in Argentina and southern France. Now, I'm going to give you more clues after the news, which is next, with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. Giant kilns that were once used to dry out tobacco leaves are to be used in experimental winemaking at a Niagara-on-the-Lake winery. Reef Estate Winery will try using two humidity and temperature-controlled sheds to make unique wines and expand their product range. The idea is to use these traditional tools from the dying tobacco industry in Essex County and give them new life in Niagara's wine business. The first kiln will be used to dry out grapes to produce a rich style of wine with more sugar concentration, like an Amarone-style wine. Other producers are already successfully making wines of this style by naturally drying out the grapes in racks, and that can take up to 6 weeks, but Reef Estate hopes to reduce the drying time to 2 weeks, allowing them to produce three batches of this style of wine each vintage. The second kiln will blast humidity to encourage the growth of the fungus Botrytis on the grapes in order to produce dessert wines.
The whole area to the left of it we reported about a couple of months ago, called the Upper Mississippi River Valley AVA, which covers that massive 4 million hectares. This Upper Mississippi River Valley AVA was created to stimulate winemaking in the area as it moves off its dependency on tobacco leaf. So it's interesting that they're trying to use the old technology for drying leaves for grapes. Whether you get a better wine from force drying, I have no idea. But the compromise is power consumption for speed. Drying on a rack uses little energy, but it is slow. Whether the new facilities will have the economic value to justify the increased cost of production, I don't know. What's next, Jane?
Well, a betting service for fine wine has been launched by Wine Exchange LiveX and MatchBet, a new online betting provider. The service allows speculators to place bets on the performance of the fine wine industry. MatchBet works by letting punters place bets on the level of the LiveX 100 fine wine index at month end. Bets can be placed on a number of possible ranges for the level of the index, and they can either be backed, which is betting that it will happen, or laid, betting that it will not happen.
Well, I don't gamble myself. Perhaps my only vice I don't have. I do think they are important for markets to function properly. They're the first stage in developing a futures market. Whether this is a good thing or not, it's a moot point. But they do create liquidity and help price discovery. Market setting price seems so old-fashioned, particularly considering what's going on in Chianti, Jane.
Yes, wineries in Chianti Classico will only be allowed to sell 80% of this year's production after members of the Chianti Classico Consorzio agreed to implement its first ever Blocco della Vendita due to fears that falling bulk prices could harm the image of the Tuscan DOCG. Under the plans, they will hold back 20% of the wines produced from the 2009 harvest for a minimum of 24 months. The aim is to avoid speculation over bulk prices during difficult trading times for the wine sector and for the region, which has been hit by falling sales in key markets such as the US. That's it from me this week, but don't forget, please visit our website 3050.co.uk where you can get these stories in full.
Cheers, Jane. I'm a bit surprised that a trade body can get people together to control the supply of wine to keep prices up. I'm not sure, but I thought these were called illegal cartels. Obviously not. I'm just surprised that a group of people can get together and legally decide to restrict production to keep prices up. But in other industries, it's considered really bad. For example, if Virgin Air and BA got together and decided they were going to restrict flights across the Atlantic to keep prices up, that would be considered colluding and illegal. I'm just confused. I think I need a book called Cartel for Dummies to explain it. But sadly, I've got one called Wine for Dummies, which is in this week's spotlight and is our book review this month. So this week's book review is Wine for Dummies by Ed McCarthy and Mary Ewing Mulligan. Wine for Dummies is a surprising book. I would have thought by now I would become pretty bored with basic books covering the same old info. After all, Wine for Dummies is geared towards the wine lovers who are at the start of their journey. But it does have a great off-the-wall style, and it did make me smirk quite a bit during the chapters. Wine for Dummies is a thorough and accessible book for novices and gives some great tips for the intermediate enthusiast. But much of the content is available in a number of other books, so it is a bit repetitive for the hardened enthusiast. That said, I did find parts of the book really interesting. For example, wine is made all over the world with a huge range of languages. And I have, and I'm sure you guys do as well, some pronunciation problems sometimes. Wine for Dummies has an excellent appendix on pronunciation of keywords, and they use this throughout the book as well, which is really good. It also has one of the best sections on America I've ever read. This is probably due to the book being written by and for Americans, and as such, the book is very American-centric. Prices are quoted in US dollars, and regions are covered from the US point of view rather than from a European or Pacific point of view. This isn't such a big problem, and it does give an insight into the way the Americans view wines, but it can be a bit annoying at times. Wine for Dummies is divided into 8 parts with 21 chapters and 400 pages. I read the book cover to cover, but it would make a fine book for dipping into and out. Part 1 and 2 cover the normal basics to wine, such as how to taste and the different types of wines, but it's in a fun way with chapter titles such as Pinot Envy. Not sure if that comes across very well on the radio. Part 2, 3 and 4 look at the Old World, New World and sparkling and fortified wines, respectively. It also contains the best description I've come across for the difference between Old World and New World wines. But at last has moved beyond the stylistic differences from the 1980s that so many people think are still relevant. By the time you've completed part 4, you've covered 300 of the 400 pages, with part 5 giving additional resources and info on wine, such as wine and food matching, which only got 5 pages, I was surprised, wine rating, 6 pages, and buying wine, 15 pages, which I thought was pretty good section, actually. Part 7 is like an FAQ with the 10 common questions and 10 myths, leaving part 8 the appendix with its excellent pronunciation guide and glossary of terms, which I mentioned earlier. One thing I didn't like was the constant reference to other books that Ed McCarthy and Mary Ewing Mulligan had written on wine, such as France for Dummy or Italy for Dummy. All in all, I found this book to be a bit basic for me, but ideally suited to novices or even intermediate wine lovers. There is more to this book than being simply for dummies of the world, and in the end, considering the audience that it's designed for, I rated this book 88 out of 100. Right, that ends this week's spotlight. Next week, we're going to be looking at autolysis, important for champagne, but also used in a huge range of wines. So we'll find out about the autolysis, or the breaking down of yeast to form flavors in wine. But next up, we have the second clue to our mystery grape variety, which should help most of you get it, hopefully. Our mystery grape variety is Spain's answer to Cabernet Sauvignon and one of the most important black grape varieties making Rioja. It makes its name from the Spanish for early because it usually ripens early and certainly a good 2 weeks before the other Riojan grape variety, Grenache, or for the rest of you guys who don't speak Spanish, Grenache. This relatively short growing cycle makes it able to thrive in the often harsh climates of Rioja's higher, more Atlantic-influenced Rioja Alta and Rioja Altvisa. Right, that ends the clue. If you're not too sure about it, I'm going to give you the answer and the clues after this week's interview with Natalie and Jill Ferve. Just a quick heads up though, at one point in the interview, I was talking about oysters in the clay. I don't actually mean live oysters, I meant their shells, and it wasn't until I listened to it later on that I realised it didn't make sense, so just consider yourself warned. And also, the show was recorded on the 22nd of July, so not too long ago, and that'll give you an idea of what we're talking about when we're talking about climates later on. But let's have a listen to this week's interview. Hi, I'm here in Shebley. I've got Natalie and Giles Verve. How are you guys?
It's okay for me.
We're here in Shebley, and you guys make wine here. What's the name of your winery?
And I'm Natalie, and our estate is Domaine Natalie and Gilles Fèvre.
Excellent. And you are?
I am Gilles.
Excellent. So you guys have got a range of different Chablis, haven't you? What's the different quality standards in Chablis?
In Chablis, we have four level in appellation contrôlée. We have Petit Chablis, Chablis, Chablis Premier Cru, and Chablis Grand Cru. And all the vineyards in Chablis is 5,000 hectares. Okay. And Chablis Grand Cru is for 100 hectares. Chablis Premier Cru, 750 hectares. Petit Chablis, 800 hectares. And the rest, 3,500 hectares, is Chablis.
Okay, what's the difference between the different types of Chablis, the top quality standards?
Petit Chablis is the first level. Donc, it's a simple wine. You have to drink it very young, with a lot of fruit, freshness. And after, the most important appellation is Chablis. With Chablis, you can have the typicity of the global appellation with minerality and fruit.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people talk about wet stones for Chablis as sort of the character.
The typical character of Chablis is the minerality and the salt. Salt and mineral.
Salt and
salt. Wine of Chablis means sea, the sea. The aroma of sea.
Oh, does it?
Voilà. Because in the soil of Chablis, you have oysters, shellfish, and all the wine of Chablis look like something who come from the sea.
Oh, okay. Interesting. I've never heard of that before.
See, the minerality, oysters, salt, little salt. Chablis is Chardonnay, but it's not like a Chardonnay. It's very different of all the other Chardonnay.
Yeah, no, it's a lot leaner usually.
Yes.
And a lot more minerally, as you say, and less fruit.
It's for this, I told you, Chablis, it's a unique soil for a unique wine. It's very different than the other Chardonnay all over the world.
I have had some cool climate wines that have that minerality that are made from Chardonnay, but they're pretty rare and pretty unique, whereas in Chablis, a lot of the wines have that. It's a lot more typical of the region. You've mentioned Petit Chablis, Chablis, Premier Cru, Grand Cru.
The difference of different wine, it's only come from the soil, the subsoil, and the exposure of the slopes. Usually, Petit Chablis come from the soil of Portlandien on the hilltops.
Portlandia is like a type of soil, isn't it? It's like a stony soil.
It's a stony soil. It's very stony. Mm-hmm. And it's very different entre Portlandien and Kimmeridgien. Kimmeridgien is with clay, limestone, but clay on the chalk.
Chalky
soil.
Yeah.
Yes. Grand Cru, Premier Cru on Chablis are always on Kimmeridgien soil.
So what is Kimmeridgien soil?
Kimmeridgien soil, it's a soil where you can find oysters, shellfish. It's a very typical soil of Chablis.
Yeah, so it's a clay, isn't it? Is it the clay with the oysters in it, or?
Yes, it's a clayer soil or limestone soil. It all depends of the different premier cru. But each premier cru, it's different.
How many different premier crus and grand crus are there?
In Chablis, we can find 72 premier cru, different premier cru.
72.
But usually we have only 15 premier cru in the market.
Mm-hmm. How many grand cru, different types of grand cru can you get?
We have seven different climats of grand cru.
Yeah.
Only in one slope, just in front of the town of Chablis, on the right side of the river, of the little river Le Serin.
Yeah.
And all the famous premier cru are on the right side, just behind or near the Grand Cru.
Okay, so there's a wee area. If you're looking at Chablis, it's just to the right of Chablis, isn't it?
No, but on the right side of the river.
I had a look at a map earlier of Chablis, And it was a wee bit strange in that normally you'd associate things like Grand Cru or the best vineyards to be on south-facing slopes, and they're not always on south-facing slopes, are they? What's driving that?
In Chablis, you'll say we are the river, Le Serein, a lot of little valleys.
Yeah, little valleys. And,
yep. Yes, and maybe we think that the famous Premier Cru and Grand Cru are the point on the hill.
Yeah.
You understand? Yeah.
Yeah, so the river sort of winds its way around.
Yes.
And then where it sort of carves out a point almost.
Yes, because we are at this place, we have a lot of erosion.
Erosion, yeah.
Yeah.
So what does that mean? Lots of erosion, so the soil's not so deep?
Erosion is... Yes, it's not rich soil. Mm-hmm. And for the vine, it's okay.
Yeah.
It's good. If the soil is too rich... the vine are a lot of vigor,
yep.
And it's not good for the wine after. Mm-hmm. No sugar, no.
So it's partly to do with the fact that it's sort of south-facing, but it's also the fact that these areas have had a lot of erosion and the soils are of lower quality, not so much quality, lower vigor.
Yes.
Okay. Is that the Grand Cru and the Premier Cru areas? They tend to be on those points?
And in Grand Cru, we have 7 different Grand Cru and 10 different little valleys.
Okay, and it's on
little
the,
valleys.
They sort of feed into the main river, don't they? There's the wee streams that go down through the valleys.
Yes, and we have different exposure,
yep.
Slopes, and different point of the hill. Yes.
I noticed when we're driving around, one of the things about Chablis that maybe makes it quite different to Chardonnays grown in the New World is that the vines are really quite close together. What's the reason for that?
We have the minimum of density, 5,000 on 500 plants per hectare.
5,500 plants per hectare.
Per hectare. But we can make more plants, we can plant more plants. It's better for the vigor. When we have a lot of plants, a concurrence between the different plants, and so we can have less vigor, and it's better for the wine. So when we have a long slope, you can choose to plant with the minimum of the density in the top, because it's not a rich soil. Down slope, you can plant a lot of plants to make concurrency on each plant to have better wine.
Okay, so up on the top of the hills, obviously you've got a lot of erosion and the topsoils come away, so the soil's of lower quality, so you have lowered planting density, whereas when you get down towards the bottom where the soils are heavier.
Yes, because usually in the downslope you have a deeper soil.
Yeah.
So it's rich.
Yeah, and so the plant is more vigorous, so...
More vigor in the downslope.
So you manage that by having higher densities.
Yes. Each wine grower knows his soils.
Yeah.
So he can decide to choose a density to make the wine that he wants.
Yeah. If you've got more vines, do you get more grapes off the same amount of area, or is it not like that? So, for example, if I had 9,000 vines in a hectare of soil, will I get more grapes off 9,000 vines as opposed to maybe 5,000 vines?
No, I think when the soil is very rich, it's not the number of grapes which are important, but the grapes are bigger.
Okay.
It's not the number of grapes, because in Grand Cru, when you have disease, mm-hmm. lot of disease, because Grand Cru are planted 200 or 300 years ago, so lot of disease. So you can have lot of grapes in Grand Cru, but not lot of quantity. With soils which are deeper, with just some grapes, you can have lot of quantity, because of grapes will be very important. When the soil is rich, the plant have lot of vigor.
Yep.
So with some grapes, you can have a lot of quantity.
Yep.
It's for this reason that you have to choose an important density, because when we have a lot of plants, each plant, it's very difficult for it to grow.
Yeah, because it's competing with all the other plants.
Competition between different plants.
So each plant's really competing quite hard, and that controls the vigor.
We have always the first, the important thing to do for a wine grower, it's to show the concurrence, the vigor, it's the most important job for a wine grower, it's to see the good vigor for his plant. It's the most important thing to do.
You mentioned some of the Grand Cru vineyards are quite old. You said 100, 200 years old for the... Is that the vines that are that age?
No. I think the oldest plant of Grand Cru, maybe 100 years ago. Okay. I think.
Yeah. Okay, so they're being pulled up and planted again regularly.
Usually, vines, we have to plant again after 60, 70 years.
What sort of temperatures do you get in Chablis? How hot does it get here in summer?
For example, today we have 30 degrees.
Was it 30 degrees today?
Yeah, today. Oh. And yesterday, 35 degrees.
Is that quite common?
Maybe, I think the middle is 25. But it depends for the year. For example, in 2006, the middle is 25 degrees. And in 2007, very bad summer. And in August, in 2007, maybe 20 degrees.
Oh, okay, so yeah. Quite a bit cooler. Okay, are you expecting, given it's so warm now, are you expecting a good vintage?
All the quality for the vintage is in August and September. And in 2007, the last week in August and all the September, very, very lot of sun, very lot of wind, north wind. Mm-hmm. And it's very good for the grapes, for the maturity.
Okay, north wind, is that a drying wind? Is it a warm wind?
Yes, okay. Dry wind, yeah.
Excellent. How do you make your wine? Do you want to just talk a wee bit about how you make it? We had a look at your cellar, and you've got lots of shiny stainless steel tanks with temperature control, so you can control the temperature during vinification.
We look for to produce wine in respect for the terroir. Mm-hmm. And we don't make Chardonnay, we produce Chablis. And we want to show all the soil through the wine. Very simple vinification. We use only the clear juice. Yep. After we press the grape, and after 2 days, we have very clear juice.
It's settled out. All the solid matter.
All the sediment. And
you don't filter?
No. And we keep just the clear juice. Mm-hmm. For Chablis and for Chablis Premier Cru Fourchaume, only vinification in stainless steel tank with controlled temperature. Yeah. And for Chablis Premier Cru Mont de Milieu and Chablis Premier Cru Vauloran and Chablis Grand Cru Les Creuses, we use some oak. Mm-hmm. And for the Premier Cru, 15%.
15% oak.
Yes, yeah. In oak. And for Grand Cru, 30% in oak. Sure. And we have 50-50, 50 new oak and 50 oak for 1 year and 2 years.
Okay, so half it's sort of old oak and some of it's half it's new oak. Okay.
And very simple vinification.
Okay.
Alcoholic fermentation and after malolactic fermentation and after racking. And with Gilles, we taste and we decide for the aging. For the aging, for 2006, we are low acidity.
Yeah.
And we don't make batonnage. Or batonnage, which is mixed wine and lees.
Yeah, so it's leaving the wines on the lees.
Yeah. And for 2006, we don't use this this process. We have low acidity, and we want to keep freshness. We have short aging.
Yep.
For 2006, maximum is 10 months. Mm-hmm. And 2007, this is very opposite than 2006. We have high acidity, and we have very long aging for... The maximum is for Grand Cru for 15 months, mm-hmm. with mixed the lees and the wine, and etc.
That's a long time for a wine to spend in tank, isn't it? Because you've got last year's vintage still in tank, while you've got the new year, new vintage in tank as well. So you need to have more equipment.
Yes.
Which can be expensive.
Yes. And for us, we are a young estate because our family was installed long years ago. But for us, the first vintage is 2004. When people visit our cellar, we say, "Welcome to the bank."
Welcome to the bank.
It's not our cellar. not yet.
Not yet. Yeah, a few more years to pay it off. you say you haven't had the cellar for very long. What did you do? Did you own the vineyard before 2004? And what did you do with the grapes?
Before this date, we were in La Chablisienne, in the cooperative La Chablisienne.
So did grapes go to co-op?
Yes. And I work in La Chablisienne during 12 years. Mm-hmm. And I'm an oenologist, and Gilles is an oenologist too. And
I heard you.
And we decide for us. It's more... not necessary for money, but it's interesting for us to work our vineyard, our wine.
Yeah.
Yes.
At least you know, for example, if you've made the wine and you've made a decision on the wine, at least it'll get expressed in the wine, whereas maybe if it goes into co-op, it'll get blended in with everybody else's and you'll lose that sort of difference, I suppose. We tasted all your wines earlier. There was about five of them.
Different wines.
What I noticed is a lot of Chablis, especially at the cheap end, is quite thin and quite acidic, whereas yours had a lovely richness to it. And you could feel the richness coming through on the difference. You went from Chablis, Premier Cru, Grand Cru. But one of the wines was one of the Premier Crus was quite soft, and it didn't taste to me like a typical Chablis. That was the Mont de Milieu. Why is that so different to the other wines?
Mont de Milieu is for us a new parcel. We don't know all history of this parcel. The first vintage for us is 2007, and in 2007 we have a very serious hailstorm. When we pick the grape, we have black grape, but dry black grape, and the rest 50, very good, very gold grape, and to separate the bad face and good face.
What happened there? Why were the grapes black?
Hailstorm was in June and in July.
You had a hailstorm.
Yes.
What sort of yields do you get off your vineyards in terms of cropping, you know, is hectolitres per hectare?
Maximum in Chablis is 60 hectolitres.
Per hectare.
Per hectare in Chablis. Okay. And maximum in Chablis Premier Cru is 58 hectolitres, but this is maximum. Mm-hmm. But it's... not the same quantity at the rear.
You guys mentioned earlier about your soils being a key driver for the style of Chablis. I believe that climate's probably the main driver for a style of wine, because obviously, you know, a Chablis from a cool climate is going to taste quite different to a Chablis from a hot climate. Do you agree with that, or do you?
I think in Chablis we don't need a hot summer, because like 2003. We have very, very hot summer, and it's not good for our wine. Mm-hmm. Because with Chablis, we need acidity and freshness. We need something like flower, white flower. And with 2003, it's impossible. Yeah. We can make a good red wine, but not a good white wine.
You don't make red wine in Chablis, do you?
And in 2003, it was very good Chardonnay, but not typical Chablis.
Yeah, so the climate is a big driver for
yes, the climate.
Well,
it's always very, very important. And we can we decide the harvest with the level of the sugar, but always with the level of acidity. It's very important to keep the good flavor.
What sort of food goes well with Chablis?
Shellfish, oyster,
yeah.
Mussel, all produce come from the sea. Just for example, grilled fish, no problem. And we have a specialty in Chablis, gougère. Gougère is a puff with cheese.
It's like a puff pastry with cheese, yeah?
Yeah. If you have older Chablis, veal, mushroom, chicken.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about older Chablis? How does Chablis change as it ages? Does it age? How does Chablis get better as it gets older? Or
it depends. It depends what do you like.
Uh-huh. How does it change?
When Chablis is young, we have fresh fruit, white flora. And after 3 or 5 years, we have dry fruit. And after 10 years, we have sous-bois. This is sous-bois, is a little white mushroom. And always with minerality.
Yeah.
After 5 years or after 10 years, we have all the minerality. But if you don't like mushroom, you don't keep in your cellar.
You don't keep for 10 years.
I think it's a problem because now nobody likes old wine. And everybody drink young wine, and it's a problem. Because I think Premier Cru and Grand Cru are at its peak after 5 years. It's not good to drink it when just the last vintage is not at its peak.
At home, I have got some Chablis. I've been collecting a juice. It's not a particularly great Chablis. It's just an Appellation Contrôlée Chablis from Domaine Pouillier. And it's just normal Chablis, but I've got it going back to 2002. I've got every vintage going back, and I'm going to try it in a couple of years' time when they're quite old. Do you think, even though they're just normal Appellation Contrôlée Chablis, they tasted right when I first bought them, do you think they would have progressed, or do you think they would have fallen to bits?
It depends for the winemaker, and it depends for the vintage, I think. For us, we want to work with the vintage. Mm-hmm. If we have, for example, 2006 low acidity, we can work this vintage. Yeah. Don't add tartaric acid, for example.
Yeah.
But we say, don't keep this vintage. Drink now.
Yeah.
Because we have... to keep the wine, we must have two, alcohol and acidity.
Yep.
And in 2006, we have alcohol, but no acidity.
Okay. So it's not a keeper.
It's good now.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I think in 1 or 2 years, maybe 3 years, but after 5 years, I don't sure. Maybe it's possible. But I don't show. And for 2007, we are high acidity, good alcohol, so you can keep.
For a long time.
No problem.
We were talking earlier about 2006, and you said that you actually bottled it while there was still quite a lot of dissolved carbon dioxide in the wine. Spritz, bubbles. In the.
I said that we work with the vintage, so no batonnage. To have, if we have batonnage, we have in 2006 fat wine,
yeah.
And in the, just for the bottling, we have lot. We keep lot of gas, just at the limit,
yeah.
To perceive the gas,
yeah.
Just at the limit.
It gives it a wee spritz, doesn't it? It makes it a bit lively.
Yes, but not sparkling wine.
Not sparkling wine.
But just the limit.
Yeah.
And now, when we taste 2006, we have no gas.
No.
It's no, yeah.
Okay. All right then, guys. I think we'll wrap it up there, let you guys get home. Thank you very much for your time.
Cheers. I hope you enjoyed this week's interview. I thought both Natalie and Giles did really well, especially considering English is not their primary language. After the interview, I did a bit of research, and I found some interesting facts about Carmarigian clay, the key soil in Chablis. So here they are. The unique Carmarigian soil in Chablis is named after the English town found in Dorset called Carmarige, where the soil is exposed to the surface. The soil itself exists across England in a band stretching from Dorset in the southwest to north-eastward East Anglia. The Cymmeridgian clay is best known in Dorset, where it forms part of the Jurassic Coast World Heritage Site. Now, there are a number of vineyards down Dorset's way, including Ian Edwards, who we spoke to last week about the UK Vintners Association and also the EU wine regulations. But his Fairlie estate is on sandy soils. And similarly, I spoke to a guy called Nigel Riggle from Woodtone, who is on green sand, similar to Nye Timber. So I couldn't find any vineyards down in Dorset who are actually on Cymmeridgian clay. Nigel from Woodtone did think that these soils probably wouldn't work in the UK. In Chablis, it's more continental climate, so you get quite dry summers, while the UK is quite wet. What this means is that clay is great at holding water, so the roots could possibly get a bit water bogged, which can kill the vines. But all that water and very high fertility soil may mean that the vine also grows completely out of control. Jill talked for quite a bit about trying to control vigour, and if you've got lots of water and clay, I can imagine the vine gets particularly vigorous and doesn't produce that much good grapes. There was also a problem that Nigel suggested, which was boggy soils can't be worked. So if you're on Cymmeridgian clay in the UK and it's wet, you may not be able to work the soils. A lot of clay-based soils in the UK are used for wheat, where you don't have to get into the fields that often. So whilst a lot of English growers go on about chalky soils being the same as Champagne, the fact that we've got Cymmeridgian clay may not mean we can make Chablis. Maybe it is pretty unique. Okay, so that pretty much ends this week's show. Note for next week, we're going to be heading over to Côte d'Or in Burgundy, and we've got Oliver Bertrand, and Oliver is a guy who showed me around Burgundy, and he also helped me arrange some of the interviews with the other producers that we're going to be talking to in the next couple of weeks. Right, but before we finish up, how did you get on with the mystery grape? Well, it was, of course, Tempranillo, Spain's answer to Cabernet Sauvignon, and one of the most important black grapes used to make Rioja. It takes its name from Tempranillo, meaning Spanish for early, because it usually ripens early. And certainly a good 2 weeks before Rioja's other important grape, Grenache. This makes Tempranillo able to thrive in the often harsh climates of Rioja's higher, more Atlantic-influenced regions, such as Rioja Alta and Rioja Alvisa. Although it produces deep-coloured wines, it doesn't have a particularly strong flavour identity, and it can be quite low in acidity. So alone, the wines can often lose their fruitiness and liveliness after a few years. And certainly 100% Tempranillo Gran Reservas, I always find a bit flat. This is the reason why a high proportion of the juice is blended with more perfumed varieties such as Grenache, Gratinho and Viura to produce wonderful wines capable of aging. It prefers deep calcareous or sandy clay soils and does best on slopes. In Spain, it's known by many synonyms including Tinto Fino and Tinto de Toro, although recent research by winemakers now suggests these namesakes are in fact different clones. Elsewhere, it's grown in Portugal, as well as Argentina and the south of France. Okay, almost all done. Just to finish up this week with a quote. Wow, actually, it's a translation of a French drinking song. I don't know if I heard this one, but I certainly heard a few of them in the south of France when I was camping. Bacchus, we thank you. You gave us wine, which warms the blood within our veins. The nectar is itself divine. The man who drinks it not yet attains, by godly grace to human rank, would be an angel if he drank. I think it loses a bit in translation. But until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.